So we're on the book of 1 Samuel, which contains the story of David and Goliath, and I could not stop thinking about that as we sang all the lyrics of that song. David wasn't specifically standing up for Jesus, but he was standing up for his God, the Heavenly Father, and seemed to have no fear as he faced someone who in every way should have outmatched him. So not going to really spend a lot of time on the story of David and Goliath today. Sorry to let you down, but it's certainly part of it, and made me think of that. So, okay. Grab a drink of water. All right, so as we go through our Bible timeline, I need a bigger arrow. The book of 1 Samuel tends to cover a little more than what one point of an arrow can actually point to on a timeline, because it goes, I guess that's fair enough if I think of, as I've illustrated it there, David as king. This book leads you right up to the door of him actually taking the reign of being king. He's anointed in this book, but he doesn't actually become king, and I'll beat that point to death as we go until 2 Samuel. But that's where we are. We're right there at the time of David. Put a brief note there, a slide that I don't normally kind of have in my outline, but I wanted to make this point before we went any farther. Our Bibles have two books with the word Samuel in them, 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, but in ancient times it was just a single scroll, just called Samuel. I don't think there's any heresy in splitting it into two books or anything, but just know that it was a single scroll. The reason it was split was purely logistical. For some reason, when they translated it to Greek, it didn't all fit in one scroll, so they split it into two. But it wasn't split randomly. The split is very, very logical. Saul dies at the end of 1 Samuel, and David becomes king at the beginning of 2 Samuel. And so it makes perfect sense where they split it. But just know that it is a single work. But I just find, I don't know, it's just too much information, I feel, to cram all into one lesson. So I think of them separately myself, out of habit more than anything. But so 1 Samuel is, of course, Samuel and the reign of Saul. And David is in 1 Samuel, as I said, before he actually becomes the king. And then 2 Samuel is nothing but David and his time as king. That's the entire point of the book. Almost to his death, but not quite. He actually, I think, has a brief appearance in 1 Kings before he passes it on to Solomon. But almost up to the end. And then, as I said, the book of 1 Samuel ends with the death of Saul, as well as his son Jonathan, which is kind of important because otherwise you would think his son would take over the kingdom, but no, the son died also. So, all right. So our summary, like I say, a lot happens in the book, but I mean I think the defining moment is that Israel demands to have a king to rule over that nation of Israel, making of course obvious the point that they didn't have a king ever before this. Joshua was a leader, but he wasn't a king. There were other judges that would lead regions, but only at this time did the people get jealous of other nations and wanted their own king, because that's the cool thing to do, and so that's what they demanded. but it's also a reaction to the fact that their priestly leaders of Eli and Samuel, they were good men, but they kind of led bad examples in that their sons were kind of off the rails. So all of that together, made that perfect storm of them really seeing the need to have a king. And then we talked about last week, the book of Judges repeats over and over again at the end there. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And so it does seem like a king isn't the worst idea in the world, but it's not really what God had intended all along. And I've made that point. Like I said, I'm going to beat it to death, but I've made this point already. Halfway through the book, David is preordained to succeed Saul. So, why is this book special? And kind of going along with that, not only is it the first king, but that means it makes it a kingdom for the first time. It was a nation of people in Egypt without a land. Then it became a country in the land of Canaan, but it was just diverse. What's that called? Decentralized leadership. But now it's consolidated into like a capital city with a single leader, like we all have come to expect, and it starts out very badly. So they struggle to kind of get on their feet. Well, Saul fails. It seems early and often. Maybe the time is not clear, and he did okay for a few decades. I'm not sure on that. Like I say, Bible timelines within a book are very difficult to parse out because they don't give you clear markings of, you know, in 1050 BC, this happened. They didn't have those absolute times, you know, so and they don't always give you markers like that. But for what we see, Saul seems to do nothing but fail, except for maybe one victory or two or something. But then, of course, that leads to the rise of David and his righteousness and good example as a king in this book. The next book, not as good. So the 2 Samuel, David falters a lot. But this book, he's a good example. the main characters, it's not a typo. The first two have the same description. Eli is a good priest who had terrible sons. Then Samuel was a good priest who had terrible sons. So kind of interesting parallel. And Samuel learned from Eli, maybe more than he wanted to. Who knows? But anyway, then you've got King Saul, who's the opposite. He's a terrible king who has an awesome son, Jonathan. And then you've got David, who's not king yet. Yes, I'm beating that to death, right? He's not king yet. He will be, but not yet. He's just this lowly shepherd boy who defeats a giant, and runs from Saul a lot. And then you've got Jonathan, who is in the unusual position of being son of a terrible king and the friend of the amazing next king. And so he's quite the, person stuck in the middle there. So for our outline, as I mentioned in the scripture reading, you kind of see a split in that chapter 15-16 region where Saul is determined that he will no longer be king, and in chapter 16, David has said that he will become the king. And so there's that kind of natural split there. But within that, I usually look at other people's outlines in preparing for this also. This tends to be the consensus of chapter breakdown, more or less. The first 7 chapters about Samuel, from his birth on up. So you kind of see his rise. And then chapters 8 through 15 is the rise and fall of Saul. So not from his birth, but just from his, being chosen king, on to his failing, but not the end of his reign. His reign does not end at chapter 15. He's just told that he will not have his kingdom carry on in his bloodline, you know, forever. But he doesn't just up and die in the middle of the book. So chapter 16, like I say, you've got David is anointed as king. He's the man after God's own heart. He's chosen to be the king that they need. And but Saul is still finishing his reign. So in politics, you call this a lame duck session. So when you've got, so there's this time in our country, for example, where the next president's elected in November, but the old president still has his job until mid-January. And so you've got this kind of, and it's the same with congressmen too. So they've got this, like, what is there, whatever that is, two and a half month period, where they still have their job, but, you know, it's basically established no one likes them anymore. And so, you know, you can kind of do two things with that. You can just give up and it doesn't matter. Or maybe you can get a lot done because, you know, you don't have to get reelected anymore. I don't know. But, anyway, that's where Saul is. He's in this sort of lame duck, situation where he's still the king, but the writing's on the wall. When he dies, it's over. His son will not take his place. And that's conveniently fulfilled by the fact that they both die on the same day. Spoiler alert, the end of the book. And so, yeah, and part of that last half, Saul just keeps trying to kill David. Yeah, and never obviously succeeds. So, so as we've been kind of hinting at the whole time, a few big themes in the book, or major doctrinal points that we usually draw out of this. We'll go ahead and turn there. 1 Samuel 8 and verse 9. I would be remiss if I didn't read this in a review of 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel 8 and verse 9. Anyway, there's a lot of context there, but the people are asking for a king, and God says basically just give them what they want, which is, you know, not what they need, but what they want. Verse 9, "Now therefore hearken unto their voice, howbeit yet protest solemnly unto them." So don't go without a fight, you know, go kicking and screaming, but go ahead and do what they say. "And show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them." So, like I say, give them what they want, but still tell them this is going to end badly. And then it does. and then if you look at 1 Samuel 13 and verse 14, this is actually the first time Saul is told his kingdom will be taken away. We focus on the Amalekite story, but this is actually mentioned. He's actually condemned a couple chapters earlier. 1 Samuel 13 verse 14, speaking to Saul, "But now thy kingdom shall not continue. The Lord hath sought him a man after his own heart, and the Lord hath commanded him to be captain over his people." Of course, we know this is David, but he's not named yet. "Because thou hast not kept that which the Lord commanded thee." So, again, first God gives them the king that they want. And, you know, Saul is very tall, so he looks the part. And David is at least young, so therefore probably not as tall. Saul was the tallest man in the country, so David was not, logically, right? But David was the one they needed. He was the one that had the right heart. And then what we read in the scripture reading is the other kind of really, really major one. I would say if you get nothing else out of this book, this would be the key verse where Saul is told, "Behold, it is better to obey than sacrifice," right? And so that's kind of the key idea there. Saul tried to do the opposite. He tried to disobey and then sacrifice. And that seems like, well, that should be a good enough cover up. God wants sacrifices. Here, I've given you sacrifices. Also, I kept some gold, you know, or whatever, right? But well, I don't know if it's gold, but, you know, the spoils anyway. He just wants obedience. So that's the, probably the biggest thing. And then something that just randomly kind of crosses my mind, from time to time, and I find it interesting. All the kings of Judah, and Israel combined are from the line of Judah, except this one guy, the first one, Saul. He's from Benjamin. And, so there's a prophecy in Genesis 49 and 10 that says the scepter will not depart from Judah. The idea being that the way I read that, once Judah, someone from the heritage of Judah takes the throne, it'll never be anybody else from any other tribe. So that it's true. David's the first one from Judah, and then everyone else after him is descended from him, who's the rightful king. And then, of course, there's the prophecy part of it that Jesus is also descended from David. But then why this one king that was from Benjamin? It's almost doomed from the start, right? Because you know that the kings are going to come from Judah if you know the prophecy. So why have the one from Benjamin? I don't entirely have an answer for that. It doesn't break the prophecy. Like I say, once there was a king from Judah, it was always from there then on. But I don't know, just something to ponder. I like leaving you with open-ended questions. So recap, again, if you're taking notes, Israel demands to have a king ruling over them, which starts off their kingdom as a proper kingdom. You've got Eli and Samuel, the priests, Saul, the king, David, the shepherd boy, and Jonathan, his friend, and also Saul's son. Then I broke it down into three sections of 1 through 7. Chapters 1 through 7 is about Samuel and his rise. 8 through 15 is the rise and fall of Saul. And then 16 through 31 is what I call the rise of David. And he doesn't really get to take effect until the next book. So that's our brief overview of 1 Samuel. And for the story that I wanted to go over in the book of 1 Samuel, I didn't pick David and Goliath. I don't know. When we studied the book of 1 Samuel, a couple years ago or whatever here, and the lesson I ended up with was David and Goliath. So I feel I've spoken enough on that, that you all don't need to hear it again. So I wanted to do something different. and so this is 1 Samuel 16, verses... I put 1 through 14. 1 through 13 is really kind of the story, but 14 has an interesting little plot twist at the end that kind of ties it. It's kind of the bridge between that story and the next one, so I threw verse 14 on there also. We'll get into the story of David being anointed king. So, have I said I'd beat this point to death? I'm going to beat this point to death. David was chosen to be king many years before he actually reigned. So why is this odd, right? So normally, the next king is going to be the son of the current king. Or if he has no sons, some kind of nearby relative, a nephew or brother or something. I'm sure each culture has their own strange, succession plan. But whatever it is, some kind of near relative, I think of Abraham. He wasn't a king, but he was very rich. And he talked about how his inheritance, he was lamenting that he didn't have a son yet. And he said, my inheritance is going to go to like some nephew or something. And he was sad about that. And so the concept I think exists from an early time, or, someone just steals the crown, right? They just have an uprising and just, kill the current king and maybe everyone in his family and just take over. But David did none of those things. He didn't steal the kingdom, and he wasn't related to the king. Not really, although he does marry Saul's daughter, but that's confusing. It seems like she just kind of disappears at some point. Anyway, but in this case, of course, Saul had the kingdom taken from him by God because he failed to obey, and was given to David. So, it's just an unusual kind of succession, compared to normal kingdoms. all right. So what makes this, story special? And we will read it, but, just to jump in the middle of it, chapter 16, verse 7, has a really straightforward explanation of what makes this story special. So I'll just read it. 1 Samuel 16 and verse 7. But the Lord said unto Samuel, look not on his countenance or on the height of his stature, because I have refused him. So the tallest, oldest brother, you know, he's not the next king. He's not the one. Four, the Lord seeth not as man seeth, for man looketh on the outward appearance, but the Lord looketh on the heart. So that's right there in a nutshell, the whole story is, and almost the whole book, right? Is that, everyone is looking on the outward appearance of someone who looks like they should be a good leader. It's funny, even Samuel does the same thing. He's like, that's gotta be the guy. And he's like, nope. I want someone who's got the right heart. All right. So our main characters, Samuel, met him already. And the priest who anoints David in this story and in the chapter before him had, I tried to find a word, defrocked, I think would be a good word for that, Saul. So he kind of stripped him of his power and glory, to a point, but not really because he still reigned. So I don't know. I don't think there's a word for this, but anyway. and you got David, the handsome shepherd boy, and then, Jesse. So, Jesse's the father of David. I want you to remember that, because that's going to come up in the poem we read at the end. You're supposed to know this when you read Isaiah, is that Jesse's the father of David. Because when we get to this poem in Isaiah 11, it just says, a shoot from Jesse. It doesn't say David anywhere. So you're kind of supposed to know who that is. So keep that in mind. Jesse's the dad. All right, so we'll go ahead and read the story. Get my glass of water here. And we'll go from there. 1 Samuel 16, starting verse 1. And the Lord said unto Samuel, how long wilt thou mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill thine horn with oil, and go, and I will send thee to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided me a king among his sons. And Samuel said, how can I go? If Saul hear it, he will kill me. And the Lord said, take an heifer with thee, and say, I am come to sacrifice to the Lord. And call Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show thee what thou shalt do, and thou shalt anoint unto me him who I name unto thee. And Samuel did that which the Lord spake, and came unto Bethlehem, came to Bethlehem. And the elders of the town trembled at his coming and said, comest thou peaceably? And he said, peaceably, I am come to sacrifice unto the Lord. Sanctify yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice. And he sanctified Jesse and his sons and called them to the sacrifice. And it came to pass when they were come that he looked on Eliab and said, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. But the Lord said unto Samuel, look not on his countenance or on the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord seeth not as a man seeth, but man looketh on the outward appearance, but the Lord looketh on the heart. Then Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. And he said, neither hath the Lord chosen this. And then Jesse made Shammah to pass by. And he said, neither hath the Lord chosen this. Again, Jesse made seven of his sons to pass before Samuel. And Samuel said unto Jesse, the Lord hath not chosen these. And a side note, I believe the first son is the oldest. I would assume that, but I did not check that. So if I am mistaken on that, I do apologize. But in time, all seven of the oldest brothers come through, one way or another. anyway, verse 11. And Samuel said unto Jesse, are here all thy children? And he said, there remaineth yet the youngest, and behold, he keepeth the sheep. And Samuel said unto Jesse, send and fetch him, for we will not sit down until he come hither. And he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy and withal of a beautiful countenance and goodly to look to. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is he. Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brethren. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. So Samuel rose up and went to Ramah. But the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord troubled him. And we'll stop there. So Like I said, that actually kind of leads into the next section. But I like the contrast there where you see that the Spirit of the Lord came upon David and left Saul. not that there wasn't enough to go around, but it's a stark contrast between the two of them. So, in case you missed it section, kind of some interesting statements here. So we're told appearance is not important, yet David was very handsome, as we see in verse 12. So that's not a contradiction. It's not that being handsome means you're not qualified for office. It's just that it's not relevant to how qualified you are. there's that. Height is not important. Yes, I'm happy about that. Does that mean David was short? Well, I mean, appearance was not important. It didn't mean that David was ugly. So if height is not important, was David necessarily short? We kind of assume this, right? Because David and Goliath and all of that, right? There's no real evidence that David was much shorter than average or anything like that. Was he shorter than Goliath? Yeah, everyone was shorter than Goliath. Even Saul, who's the tallest man in the land, was shorter than Goliath. You would think, anyway. so that's not saying too much. I think if anything, it's just that he's young. He's the youngest of eight kids. I think he's just not as tall as the brothers, because he's the youngest. In time, maybe he was a perfectly normal height. Maybe he was a normal height already, and the other brothers were just exceptionally tall. I don't know, you know, but, you know, that's not really the important detail. Again, it's not that, you know, if you're short, you're better. I'm not taking that stance, okay? you know, it's just irrelevant. Is all that is said there. But we do kind of want our leaders to be, you know, tall and handsome. Just makes them seem like they're better fitted to lead, which is silly, but it is kind of a pervasive mindset. The other thing I thought was interesting, you see how everybody is terrified that Samuel's coming to town. So it seems that everybody already knows, even though it was just the previous chapter that Saul lost the throne. It seems that everybody knows in the area that this has happened. So gossip spreads quickly, I guess, or maybe not gossip, but maybe it was proclaimed. I don't know. But and we don't know how much time has passed by, I don't think, either. At least I don't. Yeah, it's just kind of funny. So it wasn't a secret. When I meant to research, and I don't recall, I don't know how long it takes for Saul to find out that David is his replacement, but it seems that he does in time. But it wasn't time yet for him to know, and that's the idea. At least need some safety to be able to do the anointing before Saul starts to try to kill David. So kind of a theological, if you will, point to be made out of this. And I'm sort of taking this from the whole book of Samuel, if you will. But, you know, I like to note that godly leaders do know that they're up to the task. So they need to be humble. And David, I would say, was very humble. But that's not the same thing as being afraid to lead. We kind of assume it is, or we portray it that way. You know, if you're out there saying, I'll do it, you know, that doesn't sound humble. But I think you can be both. You can also be proud. Don't get me wrong, but, you can be humble and still be willing, to lead. If someone is to lead and they have no confidence, how could they feel right about the decisions they make? If you don't think that you're the right man for the job, and that you're going to do a good job, How could you not feel terrible about every decision you make? How could you feel confident saying, let's go to war? I want you to put your life on the line for this cause, unless you have some confidence in those decisions. So, leaders, I think, do need to know what they're doing. Saul was afraid to lead. He doubted himself when he's first called in 1 Samuel 9. And then I'll look at 1 Samuel 10, verses 21 and 22. It's really funny. This is the day when Saul is supposed to stand up in front of everybody, and Samuel say, look, here's your first king. And 1 Samuel 10, 21 to 22. When he had caused the tribe of Benjamin to come near by their families, the family of Matri was taken, and Saul, the son of Kish, was taken. And when they sought him, he could not be found. Then they inquired of the Lord further if the man should come thither, and the Lord answered, behold, he had hid himself among the stuff or among the baggage. So it's the day when Saul is supposed to come out and, stand up in front of the people as king, and he's hiding. So that's not a good sign. That's not humility. That's he's afraid to lead. It only gets worse from there, it seems. Because when it was time for him to obey God, by waiting in chapter 13 and by killing the enemies, Saul chickened out. He wasn't confident to do what the Lord asked. David, on the other hand, is the opposite, right? He demands to lead. When he faces Goliath, and we can turn there, chapter 17. So we'll briefly talk about David and Goliath. Chapter 17, 33 to 35. He wants to go fight against Goliath, and Saul, the king, tries to talk him out of it. Verse 33, chapter 17. And Saul said to David, thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth, and he a man of war from his youth. But David, speaks up for himself. Verse 34. And David said unto Saul, thy servant kept his father's sheep. And there came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock. And I went out after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and smote him and slew him. Through 37. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing that he hath defied the armies of the living God. David said, moreover, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said unto David, go, and the Lord be with thee. One of Saul's good moments to at least take his advice. But David knew that he was up to the task, and he knew that his country needed him, and he was willing to go out there and fight for it. But not just because he thought highly of himself, but he knew that the Lord is the one that delivered him in the past and would in the future. And that's what made him different. So it's not that it's a admirable quality to think that you're not good enough. It's okay. We need that. If you know where I'm going with this, we need that in the church too. We need people that know that, they know what's right. Obviously, if you don't know what's right, okay, fine. maybe don't lead, but, if you do know what's right, you need to step up. So our recap, as we said, David was chosen to be king, many years before he actually was king. It's special, of course, because God looks at the heart, and not just at outward appearances. Got Saul, David, and Jesse. Remember Jesse's the father of David. Remember this. And I had to kind of rearrange things to fit them on the slide. I won't go over the outline because, there's a lot there, but, we've kind of talked about that appearance is not the most important thing. And that everyone knew that Saul was rejected. So we'll finish up with Isaiah 11, and that's our poem of the day. So take a second to get there. So, Isaiah 11, no surprise, prophecy of the Messiah. that's comes up a lot in Isaiah. As we said, remember, Jesse is the father of David. And so this is where it talks about Jesse, but never mentions David. But you know that that's what's implied. And there's sort of you can see a dual meaning going on here. You know, a branch will grow from the stem or stump of Jesse. And so your first thought is, well, that's David. But David already reigned. This book is written hundreds of years later. So who is this talking about? And that's when you realize it's the Messiah. It's the Christ, who has qualities like the good qualities of David. So, let's go ahead and read it and then we'll wrap up from there. So Isaiah 11, starting verse 1. And there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him. That kind of sounds like what we read earlier about David. The Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord, and shall make him of quick understanding in the fear of the Lord. And he shall not judge after the sight of his eyes. That sounds like what we read, right? Don't judge by appearances. Neither reprove after the hearing of his ears, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor, and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth, and he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked, and righteousness shall be the girdle of his loins, and faithfulness the girdle of his reins. And then you get a very cryptic section, which, as Walter pointed out, this is where some of these books love to take inspiration from. Verse 6, the wolf shall also dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid or goat, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them, and the cow and the bear shall feed their young ones. And the cow and the bear shall feed, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox, and the suckling child shall play on the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the cockatrice den. They shall neither hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the water covers the sea. So I don't know that I could entirely explain all that, but a kind of brief section in the middle of a peacefulness is kind of at least the general idea you get there, right? Verse 10, we kind of come back to some things we understand a little better. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign of the people. To it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria and from Egypt and from Pathros and from Cush and from Elam and from Shinar and from Hamath and from the islands of the sea. And he shall set up an ensign for the nations and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. The envy also of Ephraim shall depart, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not envy Judah, and Judah shall not vex Ephraim. But they shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west. They shall spoil them of the east together. They shall lay their hand upon Edom and Moab, and the children of Ammon shall obey them. And the Lord shall utterly destroy the tongue. Shall utterly destroy the tongue of the Egyptian sea, and with his mighty wind shall he shake his hand over the river, and shall smite it in the seven streams, and make men go over dry shod, and there shall be an highway for the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, like as it was to Israel in the day that he came up out of the land of Egypt. So the ending there, of course, is that hope of the remnant coming home, not only the remnant of captive Jews abroad, but it seems a broader application to the Gentiles as well. that all would be under this one Messiah. So, all right, mouth's additionally dry today, but we'll end there. And if there's any that have wandered far away from God, and are in exile, in your own way, either have never obeyed the call of the gospel or obeyed but wandered away, then this is of course a good time to repent of those things, and to obey the call of the gospel. If there's any here that need the prayers of the saints, then please do so as we stand and sing.